From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the future of the telephone landline.
The technology that has run our phone system for 100 years is not working anymore.
Not everybody has broadband in their backyard. Not everybody is able to have a wireless telephone.
A Michigan philanthropist hopes his gift to help the DIA and Detroit pensioners will inspire others to follow suit.
If we get this accomplished, what a wonderful story to come out of this to counteract all the negative stuff that's being coming out of the bankruptcy.
And should third graders be held back if they can't read?
Third grade seems to be a turning point, that if you can't read at grade level in third grade, you're going to struggle throughout your academic career.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks for joining us on this very cold Monday. The State House is expected to take up a controversial telecommunications bill. This measure would let providers like AT&T end traditional landline phone service as long as there's internet phone service that can take its place. But in some rural areas in Michigan, internet service can be spotty. On today's show, we look at what the legislation could mean for you. Then later in the hour, could private philanthropy save the art at the DIA? But first, what happens when a child struggles to read at his or her grade level? Well, in many cases, the student moves up a grade anyway, and the struggle continues, resulting in high school grads who are poor, ineffective readers. And that impacts the student's chances of going to college or succeeding at college and then getting a job that can provide a good level of pay over a lifetime. There's a package of bills sponsored by Holland Republican Representative Amanda Price, now working through the legislature. It tries to tackle the problem. It's called the Read or Flunk Law. In a nutshell, if third-grade kids aren't reading, you hold them back. Ron French reported on the pros and cons of these bills for Bridge Magazine. Welcome back to Stateside, Ron.
It's a pleasure to be here, Cynthia.
So why third grade?
Third grade, there have been a lot of studies on this. Third grade seems to be a turning point, that if you can't read at grade level in third grade, you're going to struggle throughout your academic career. Superintendent Mike Flanagan likes to say that you can tell – you can predict graduation rates in the future by just looking at third grade reading levels. And so everyone agrees that this is the turning point. You either are going to do well in school or not do well in school, depending on how you're reading in third grade.
So up to that point, they're learning to read, but by the time they're in third grade, they should be reading to learn.
Absolutely.
And so thus focusing on that. So based on the standardized test results from last year, about how many Michigan third graders would have been held back if this law had been in place?
If this law had been in place last year, about 39,000 third graders would have been held back compared to 1,000 that actually were held back.
Well, that is a lot of youngsters repeating third grade.
Well, it's a little over a third of all third graders would be getting notified in the summer that, hey, you're going to be in Mrs. Smith's class again.
You know, and it's kind of interesting. I guess if you're going to hold a youngster back, the younger grade is probably a better time to do it than having them flunking seventh or eighth grade and being held back. But this bill certainly has its critics. I mean, at first blush, you would say, well, if they're not reading, then they shouldn't move ahead because the hole's going to get even deeper. But there are critics.
Yeah, it makes sense when you first hear it.
Yeah,
absolutely. It's like, well, if this is so important, let's make sure that they don't move on until they can read. And it makes a lot of sense in some ways. But what you find is that holding kids back have some of the same negative impacts that you see in with kids not being able to read very well. That children who are retained in their grade at early levels tend to have much higher dropout rates. So it's a two-edged sword.
So they may have dropout down the road because they can't read, or they have higher dropout rates if they're retained at those lower levels.
Absolutely.
Now, this has been done in other states, right?
Yes. Something that happens in 14 other states and the District of Columbia. This has all been a recent thing. Florida's had it the longest.
Mm-hmm.
And what you find there is some mixed results. You find that the children who were retained in third grade tend to be held back in grades at a lower rate as they go through their school year.
Okay.
But you also find that the academic increase that you see fades out after about 4 or 5 years.
Really? So the burst might be good in fourth or fifth grade, but by the time they're in high school?
By the time they're juniors and seniors, they're performing on tests equally with kids who were not held back.
So it seems like the long-term results might not be there to warrant holding, as you say, we might have held back 39,000 kids.
If you think of it this way, it's very important, and there's a good return on investment if it's going to work.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But for every kid who's held back, they're going to be in school another year, right?
Right.
And that is a minimum of $7,000 more for taxpayers. And so you're talking over about a quarter of a billion dollars at last year's rate of kids not doing well in the reading test.
So that's a pretty stiff price tag.
Well, and that's something that you pay over a period of time. But then the following year's third graders, if you hold back another third of those, that's another $250 million. But then this is all complicated, Cynthia, by the fact that we don't even know what the standardized tests are going to look like.
Because, Common Core.
Because Common Core is going into effect. And so everyone who looks at this assumes that the tests are going to be more rigorous and a higher percentage of children are going to be found unproficient in reading.
So it strikes me that perhaps instead of saying we're holding back third graders, we look at what we might not be doing right in grades 1 and 2 or even in preschool and put some resources into that.
Well, this is part of the bill, and it's a fascinating sort of dichotomy you have. You have a line in the sand in third grade, and we're just going to flunk you if you don't do well.
Mm-hmm.
But the other half of these bills looks at intensive intervention in starting kindergarten, first grade, second grade, including notification of parents saying, "Hey, your kid's struggling. They're going to be held back in third grade unless they find a way to read better." So that's all good. But
I hear a but.
There's a but there. Intensive intervention costs money. No one's doing it for free. And at the moment, these bills includes $0 for that intervention.
So that is what's drawing the ire of critics, I've got to imagine, all over. I know there was a big editorial in the Free Press saying, bad idea. So I'm sure there are those in the educational community who find this an appalling idea as well, only because it sounds like you're punishing these kids, but you're not putting the money into what's needed to boost things at the earlier ages.
Right. Supporters of this bill argue that, schools are there to teach our kids. And if they're not reading up to level, they're not doing their job now anyway, they should actually do their job. It's a very simplistic argument, but that's the argument that's made. And,
okay.
And I understand that point of view.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not being done now. What these intensive interventions are one-on-one or very small group, and you obviously are talking about more personnel. It cannot be done with the personnel they have now. So someone has to pay those personnel. And so that money has to come from somewhere. It's a question, if you do not give them more money, you're going to have to cut other programs someplace. Is it high school band? Is it whatever? Maybe in the long run that's the right thing to do. I don't know. But there is a cost to this that people should know about.
And the sponsor of the bill is Representative Amanda Price, a Holland Republican. What is her answer when asked about the lack of funding, no money for that remedial work?
Right. Representative Price and many supporters of this feel that the school's got enough money now. That's basically their point of view. It's that we shouldn't have to supplement schools every time we ask them to do something to teach our kids. I mean, that's how they would say it. And I understand that point of view.
Mm-hmm.
We spend $1 billion a year per grade, and they're saying that's a lot of money. Actually, you should try to figure out a way to change your resources so that you can do this. The opposite side also obviously is it's going to take more people, and people have salaries.
And Florida spent the money, yes?
Florida spent some money.
Okay.
Yeah. And so they've had, as I said, some mixed results.
Yeah.
But the question is, are those positive results a factor of retaining kids, or is it because they were having intensive intervention that they paid for?
Now, what about, are there exemptions, ESL kids or kids with learning disabilities?
Absolutely, Cynthia. That's a very good point. There are many exemptions. And for kids who are, English is a second language, for children who are learning disabled.
Mm-hmm.
And also, some kids just aren't good test takers. What if their dog died that morning? There are many reasons why you may not do well on one particular test on one day. You can also move on to fourth grade, even if you do poorly on this one test, if you do well on other kinds of tests, or if you have a portfolio that your teachers put together throughout third grade year showing that you do well. Principals can make a decision that, yes, this kid really is a decent reader. We're moving them on anyway. There will be exemptions. But even with all those exemptions, even supporters say the minimum they see being held back is about 8,000 children, which is eight times more than are being held back now.
Which suddenly there's a whole issue of logistics and kids coming up and fitting everybody together, too, I would suspect.
You're going to need more third grade teachers.
If it passes, you know, what are you hearing from lawmakers as far as its possibility and prospects for passing?
It's in flux right now. It seemed like it was going through. And then last week, the Republicans put brakes on it. And they're saying that we want to look at this more. There needs to be more debate about this. It seems to me that these bills are going to be at least tweaked a bit before they are voted on in the House and the Senate.
And if it passes, we're talking about House Bill 5111 and House Bill 5144. So if those bills pass, how soon would they take effect? Are there kids in school now that would impact?
As currently written, these bills would take effect. Well, the first children who would be affected by this are now in kindergarten. So they would have first grade, second grade, and third grade to get up to speed. So it's not like someone is going to be hit blindsided by this.
So at this point, it's kind of they put the brakes on. There's tweaking. There's no sense yet when they might take a vote on this.
No, but legislators are very active on this. There will be some sort of vote, whether it's in December or January. I don't know. But there's enough movement on this that something's going to happen.
Ron French, Bridge Magazine writer, keeping us up to speed on the bill that basically is called the Read or Flunk Law. Ron, thank you so much.
Thank you.
There's been a new development in the unfolding story about federal judge Gerald Rosen and his bid to protect the DIA collection and the pensions of Detroit City retirees. Judge Rosen is serving as the mediator in the Detroit bankruptcy case. We've been hearing how he's trying to craft together a plan wherein at least 10 national and local charitable foundations would kick in about $500 million for a fund that could be leveraged to not only protect the DIA treasures, but to lessen the pain of retiree pension cuts. Well, late last week, a former Wayne State University chemistry professor stepped forward with an offer. First, a bit of background. Dr. A. Paul Skop developed a molecule that created light through chemistry. His discovery proved very useful in a wide range of medical tests. He then founded the company Lumigen and made many millions as a biotech entrepreneur. Over the years, Paul Skop has given many millions back to Wayne State, to Hope College, to professors and researchers. Now Paul Skop is donating $5 million to help the DIA and the city retirees. Dr. A. Paul Skop joins us now. Hello.
Hi, Cynthia.
Well, why did you pick up that phone and say, I have an offer I want to make you, and it's a $5 million offer?
Well, actually, it started with an email. I read on Thursday morning early, I was reading the article that John Gallagher had written concerning Judge Rosen's plan to both assist the DIA and the pensions. And, you know, he described the attempt to get the funding from the major foundations. And I said to my wife, Carol, that's nice, but that's going to be a hard sell. And I said, what if we begin things with individual contributions, perhaps family foundations might jump in and show these major foundations that there's really sort of a groundswell of support for the DIA, but we didn't know how to approach it. And so I sent an email to John Gallagher, the reporter, who apparently, and I find out now, he did forward this to the judge, and within a few minutes I received a call from the judge.
I bet you did.
And I subsequently, the next day, had lunch with him.
And what can you tell us about that meeting with Judge Rosen on Friday?
Well, he's, you know, things are still developing, so I have to be careful about that.
Yes.
But it's fair to say that Judge Rosen was very appreciative and very excited about this approach by individuals to participate in this hopefully this solution.
What were you feeling over these weeks and months that, as this bankruptcy story has unfolded, and particularly as it's kind of boiled down to this DIA versus pensioners, what were your thoughts and feelings?
I think it's one feeling, one thought is one of frustration. I mean, both of these problems, protecting the DIA and protecting pensions, are both legitimate concerns. But to have the two of them sort of opposed to each other just seemed awful. And Judge Rosen's idea is a fantastic one, but it's a matter of how we get it funded and done.
Because it is a heavy push to have these foundations
sell
this to their boards.
All of us, a lot of us in the metro area have been saddened by all of this, frustrated by this, and I think there's a lot of people who are out there wanting to help.
So you had your lunch with the judge on Friday. He is, I'm sure, extremely happy that you as an individual have stepped forward with a donation. And we know the Community Foundation of Southeast Michigan was inspired enough by the story of your gift to set up a website.
What happened is after they saw the story about our pledge, people began to call the newspapers, also the Community Foundation independently, and wanting to express a way that they could get involved.
So it seems that you have kind of tapped into something that wasn't really recognized, and that was the desire by individuals who have watched this, and maybe they don't live in Detroit, but they want to help out.
Absolutely. I think there's hundreds, if not thousands, of people who are very, very concerned about these problems and want to be able to help.
So then the Community Foundation of Southeast Michigan put up CFSEM.org. And what did you learn about the first donor?
Oh, yeah. Robin Farabee of the Community Foundation, in a phone call, told me that the first donor was a lady from Petoskey. I think that just illustrates how wide-ranging this concern and this want to help extends.
Paul, what do you see as the end game to what you have chosen to do?
Well, I hope that what we're attempting to do stimulates others who can do things in various levels of the financing, whether it's a small gift, hopefully lots of major gifts. And the end game, should, as Judge Rosen has put out, should be an independent DIA and funding of pensions so that we minimize the hurt there.
Is there an answer that you might have to those who say, well, good for Dr. Scott, I don't have millions to give away? You just referenced that even a small gift could make a difference.
Absolutely, the small gift does, because it illustrates that there is a lot of people in this metro area, this whole state, maybe beyond this state, that are sensitive to these two problems and want to help to whatever extent they can. It's frankly like voting, expressing one's concern and wanting to help.
So I think I'm hearing a broader message, really, of a realization that Detroit's fortunes affect Michigan's fortunes.
Absolutely. And if we get this accomplished, if the judge does, what a wonderful story to come out of this to counteract all the negative stuff that's coming out of the bankruptcy.
Dr. A. Paul Scott, thank you so much for talking with us today on Stateside.
You're welcome, Cynthia.
And as news broke Friday of Scott's donation, you might say history allowed itself just a bit of a smile. You see, that story of the Scott donation came 131 years to the day that a meeting of Detroit's wealthier citizens led to the actual creation of the Detroit Institute of Arts. It was December 6, 1882. A meeting was called at the home of a railroad tycoon named James Joy. Some of Detroit's most influential and wealthy citizens were at that meeting, including newspaper publisher James Scripps. He was the founder of the Detroit Evening News, which later became the Detroit News. Their mission, to organize an art exhibit for Detroit. Scripps used his position to help whip up local interest and to encourage local philanthropists to pull together an exhibit using borrowed art. That happened in 1883, just a year later, and from that exhibit came the push to create a permanent museum, which resulted in the Detroit Institute of Arts opening its doors in 1886. One of Shakespeare's great tragedies is King Lear, the story of the ancient British king who devises a love test in hopes of dividing his kingdom equally among his three daughters. An English professor at the University of Michigan, Flint, has taken King Lear and, working with her students, set the scene in Flint and turned it into a staged reading called Lear Reassembled. They'll be performing it tomorrow and Thursday. Mary Jo Keatsman, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you.
So just to refresh our collective memory, remind us again how the tragedy of King Lear unfolds.
Well, King Lear gets very angry when his favorite daughter doesn't kiss up to him and tell him how much that he's so wonderful and that she loves him. So he banishes her. The other two daughters turn out to be very cruel, and they wind up thrusting him out in a storm at night. There's a subplot with an earl in the kingdom, and he has two sons. One is an illegitimate bastard. One is a good son. He misjudges and trusts the wrong son, and he, in the end, gets blinded and thrown out on the heath. And so the old men are out there kind of realizing that they sort of couldn't see the truth in their own families because they were pretty disconnected from their children. And it's sort of a play about learning to feel again through the very basic feeling of becoming homeless and being vulnerable to the elements.
So then, with that in mind, what inspired you to rework King Lear and to set it in Flint?
Well, I guess like just the idea that everyone is so many people have been thrust out in Flint. I mean, everybody's lost their jobs in Flint, not just the king. And many, many people are homeless or, you know, searching for meaning and looking for a fix, like a way to repair things. And I think, like, the insight in King Lear is that social tragedy and social violence begins in homes, in families, where there is a disconnect or a communication breakdown. And that seemed very, very fitting as a theme to kind of explore some of the problems in Flint.
You come in with perspective that that is tremendous. You came from Boston, but you've taught around the world. So you bring that global view to what's happening in the streets of Flint.
Right. Well, I mean, what's happening in Flint is happening in many places in the world. I mean, the places where I have taught are, you know, northeastern Kazakhstan, which the Russians used as a kind of industrial dumping ground, and central Anatolia in Turkey. These are places that a lot of the world sort of writes off as forgotten. That's happening in Flint. And the problem is people here in Flint, they want to get out. Students come in for classes and then they leave. So I think there needs to be a reeducation that Flint is a fine place to live, and people need to want to learn about it and live here and work here. And that's what we need to sort of start bringing life back.
So tell us how you went about reworking Shakespeare's play.
Yeah, I'll tell. Well, we have three storylines in our play. Lear is a GM worker who took the buyout, used his buyout money to purchase a scrapyard because he has this vision that he's going to save Flint single-handedly by disassembling cars and selling parts. So anyway, his thing is that he believes that men in Flint have to keep working, and work is the way to save the city. His daughters don't agree with him. So one daughter wants to go to art school. He gets very angry that she's, you know, abandoning this family project. Then his other daughter wants to sort of take over the business and use it as a front for selling drugs. So that's our Lear plot. Then the subplot, we have a guy who was a buddy of Lear's on the assembly line, and he was laid off. He started buying abandoned properties in the North End and growing marijuana and selling marijuana, kind of low-level cottage industry drugs. He's got two sons. One is just coming out of prison. The other one is an aspiring street poet. and he mistrusts, he misjudges his sons and trusts the one that's just coming out of prison and is really very angry and is malicious.
So that's the Gloucester storyline.
Right, that's the Gloucester storyline.
Mm-hmm. And then the collective fool.
Well, in Shakespeare's play, like, the wisdom comes from fools and beggars and people that, you know, you would never think would be the philosophers of the play. So for our fool storyline, we have, like, U of M Flint English majors who take up a teacher's challenge to go out in the world of Flint and see how their English degrees are really relevant and what they can do with those degrees. So the students are out kind of wandering around trying to learn about Flint and testing the truths that they've picked up from books. And they run into a homeless man, and they're mugged at one point in the play, and one of the students gets scared and runs out into a big brown field, Chevy in the Hole, which is our Heath. And she kind of runs into the characters in the main plots who are out there in a night on the brown field in a storm.
I'm speaking with Mary Jo Keatsman. She's an English professor at the University of Michigan, Flint. And working with her students, they've taken Shakespeare's King Lear and set it in Flint, reworked it, calling it Lear Reassembled. Let's take a listen now to a bit of a rehearsal of Lear Reassembled.
Everything is falling apart. What become of the pieces of something nobody can respect? Can they be built into something respectable? Phantom pieces of a phantom whole? I think it's all over, and we thought we were making progress.
And I thought we were making change. I thought my legacy was secure. It was a handful of dust thrown to this godless wind.
You use the language of Shakespeare?
Not really.
Okay.
I mean, there are bits of Shakespeare's language in Lear, but not a lot. It's mostly students having rewritten it. And Green's language is all rewritten. The student who also speaks in the scene, she's lost and she's spilled her bag. And in her bag, she finds a letter that's very meaningful to her. And it's by the poet John Keats. And she reads fragments of Keats's letter. So the student winds up talking to Lear, and she realizes that these insights that she's gotten from books are actually quite meaningful to, you know, this old factory worker. And it's very, very beautiful, too, because, like, I have a lot of students who have parents who worked on the line or grandparents. And one girl in the class, her father, after he was laid off, he suffered a kind of breakdown, and his wife left him, and his life was just in shambles. And she told the class that he always had this motto, and it was, "It's not for us to wonder why, just do or die." Mm. And somehow, you know, the class, I guess maybe I suggested, having heard it from a friend, that that motto is actually from Tennyson's poem, The Charge of the Light Brigade. So Jackie's father, who, you know, was a factory worker, had kind of used this scrambled poetic line as his life motto.
Yeah. What do you hope that your students have learned about not only their city but about themselves through first studying Shakespeare's King Lear and then working with you to develop this rewritten play, Lear Reassembled?
Huh. Well, I hope that they've all learned not to be afraid of the world, and that really what an education should prepare us to do is to seek reality and to go out in the world with the truths that we have and find more and use them in the world. So to be curious and to read the world and to engage with reality. And, you know, people that don't feel and are disconnected from the place where they live are not going to see anything because they're not feeling anything. And that's a big message in Shakespeare's play.
Mary Jo Keatsman is a professor of English at the University of Michigan, Flint. Her students have taken Shakespeare's play King Lear and turned it into a staged reading set in Flint called Lear Reassembled. They'll be doing this staged reading December 10th and December 12th. Mary Jo, thank you so much for talking with us on Stateside.
Oh, thank you, Cynthia.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The calendar says it's still fall, but much of the nation seems quite mired in winter. The Detroit Lions playing yesterday in Philadelphia, for instance, the game dubbed the Snow Bowl for very good reason. Here in Michigan, we've escaped the brunt of those big winter storms, making travel so dangerous in states like Minnesota, Texas, the Mid-South, the Northeast. But we do have snow and cold weather ahead for the week in Michigan. So let's find out who's getting snowed on as we say hello to MLive meteorologist Mark Torregrossa of FarmerWeather.com. Hiya, Mark.
Good day. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. Well, listen, no matter what you are about to tell us, it cannot be as bad as that photo of Calvin Johnson during the Snow Bowl yesterday in Philly with a helmet full of snow. The poor man couldn't even see. That was unreal.
That was. That was. I remember back in the days of being a kid, that was the great time to play football, though, because you tackled really hard, and when you fell, it was a little bit easier. So we have missed those big storms, but we're going to peck away at snow here in Michigan, and that can be a little tricky because I think sometimes the first inch is the most dangerous. Once you get up to the 3, 4, 5 inches and it gets nasty, it seems like everybody slows down. And sometimes the flake size is real important and how it reacts on the roads. And when you get real cold weather like this, the flakes tend to be real tiny, and although you don't pile up inches, you pile up those tiny flakes, and the plow doesn't really get them off the road real good. You drive over it, it mashes it down, and then you start to see this, sheen on the road. So that's what we'll probably be faced with off and on in places all through this week. If I looked at the weather pattern and I tried to guess what date it was, I would say January 25th.
Well, you've been saying all along we are getting early winter, and it certainly has proven out, Mark. And I saw the term in your MLive story, unorganized spurts of snow, which means it sounds like all bets are off as far as what we might get and when.
Yeah, what that means is you're not going to find huge amounts. But, for example, now we have a pattern running through the Flint and Ann Arbor and Lansing area. And that's what you'll get is these patches of 3 to 6 hours and inch of snow, and it kind of creeps up on you and gets a little sneaky. The places that will get heavy snow, though, Traverse City up to the ski resorts in the northwest part of the Lower Peninsula, maybe parts of southwestern Michigan from Grand Rapids westward could get 5 or more inches of snow in the next 4 or 5 days. And there's more to come. I see maybe a brief warming trend into the 30s or 40 for a day or so in the next couple of weeks. But otherwise, it's just January weather.
Hey, is it too early to get you to commit to a white Christmas?
I think it will happen. I think it will happen because I see only 1 or 2 days before that, you know, somewhere in December where we might get 32, 35, 38, and then back cold. So if I were a betting man, I would say chances are a better chance of white Christmas than not this year.
MLive meteorologist Mark Torregrossa, also of FarmerWeather.com. Thanks so much, Mark.
You're welcome.
These days, more and more people are so attached to their cell phones, they've decided they don't really need a landline at home. The FCC tells us the number of landline customers in Michigan was around 7 million in 2000. By 2012, that number had shrunk to about 3 million. A controversial bill sponsored by Battle Creek Republican Senator Mike Knopfs has just passed the state Senate and is on to the House. It would allow phone companies to phase out traditional landline service starting in 2017, letting phone companies discontinue the service to homes as long as some type of newer phone service is offered, such as voice over internet protocol. So let's talk about this legislation as we welcome Matt Resch, who's Public Affairs Director for Michigan AT&T. Hi, Matt.
Hi there. How are you?
Good to have you with us. And we also welcome Melissa Seifert, who's the Associate State Director of the Michigan AARP. Welcome to the program, Melissa.
Thanks for having me.
I want to start with you, Matt. AT&T maintains this bill will not remove landlines from our homes or businesses. So what does it do?
Well, I appreciate you having us on because it's an opportunity, I think, to clarify some things that have been said. And I don't blame folks for not necessarily understanding or even caring as how their phones work behind the wall and, you know, in the ground and over the wires. But, you know, this is not an issue about cutting off the wires that approach someone's home and handing people a cell phone. And I think a lot of people have read some reports and have thought that that's what this is really about. What this is really about is the little wire that comes into our house, that's been coming into our house for 100-plus years, is now able to carry emails, pictures, TV shows. All of that can come over that exact same wire. But what state law requires of companies like AT&T and other communications providers is that we use that wire to only offer a voice service. So you and I were talking before we came on, Cynthia, about the fact that you have your voice service through Comcast, mm-hmm. through a VoIP product, and then you said you have a landline. Under state law, you technically don't have a landline. You still have that copper wire that's coming into your house.
Okay.
The product that is coming into your house is an internet product. And that is really what this transition is about. And what Senate Bill 636 does is it defers to the Federal Communications Commission to tell states like Michigan and across the country when we are able to fully make this transition for customers to receive their phone service over an internet product as opposed to the 100-plus-year-old infrastructure that has been around for generations.
Okay. So, Melissa, from the AARP point of view, what does this bill mean to you and what are your chief concerns?
Our chief concerns are reliability and accessibility. Matt made some very valid points, and, you know, he's been working for AT&T for quite some time and is really the technical guru on this stuff. I represent 1.4 million members, and I can tell you in a poll that we recently did for AARP members and non-members, 97% are opposed to this bill. They have mothers, they have fathers, they have grandparents, they may have disabled children, and their concern is the reliability of the services that Matt was speaking to. Not everybody has broadband in their backyard. Not everybody is able to have a wireless telephone. And if we do away with landlines, those are your options, a voice over internet protocol or a wireless service. The scary thing is that these may not be reliable services. Also, they are rather expensive. People typically have a landline. They may pay $20 right now for that. And if we move to this legislation that it's proposing, that is going to cost seniors and families a lot of money. I also want to point out that 2 years ago, a piece of legislation was passed through the legislature that would require the PSC, if anybody wanted to stop providing a landline service like AT&T or any other voice provider, wanted to stop providing that service, they could do that now. They can go through a review from the Public Service Commission, and as long as the Public Service Commission does this review and sees that there's two comparable services in the area, they're more than welcome to stop serving areas. We're concerned about this consumer protection that would do away with if this legislation is passed.
With having the Public Service Commission involved as a part of this equation.
In the current law that stands, the Public Service Commission is very much a part of it. They can go in and do a review. This new law, Senate Bill 636, if it is enacted, would do away with the control from the Public Service Commission and tie their hands. It would be up to the consumer to then file a complaint with the Public Service Commission, and it wouldn't be the other way around.
Okay, Matt, how do you address that?
Well, the main reason for the streamlining of the process and deferring to the Federal Communications Commission is that the federal law that the FCC uses to review this process requires input from state commissions, whether it be from Michigan, Illinois, Ohio, anywhere. State commissions play a very active role. And in fact, the Michigan Public Service Commission has already filed two briefings with the Federal Communications on this very issue. So they are very much involved already at the federal level and in the federal review process of this issue. It really is, it's a streamlining of the process so that it can be facilitated so that this technology can be deployed even faster and even better. One thing that Melissa mentioned is the availability of broadband, and it was just recently released by the state, by the Public Service Commission, that 98.5% of all Michigan households have access to broadband. And really, that's all that's necessary to have a voice over internet service. If you have access to broadband at your house, and we know that 98.5% of all households in Michigan have access to a sufficient speed of broadband to carry someone's voice, they have access to these new services.
Then what about the 1.5% that don't?
first of all, in the time period that this transition is going to take place, and one thing to remember is the bill doesn't come into effect until 2017, and that doesn't even mean that the Federal Communications Commission will have completed their review or their work by that time. We could be looking 5, 6, 7, 8 years down the road before this transition is made. So certainly in that time, that 1.5% will have built out to their houses, or during that period of time, a wireless alternative will be blanketing the entire country at that point. That could be something that could be a comparable service for those customers.
When I just think of the history of communication, we've seen technology advancing, and have we not seen kind of these, if we want to call them growing pains, or this overlap of concerns when there's been a leap? I mean, once upon a time we had party lines, and then those went away. And is there usually this kind of friction, if you will, when there's a jump ahead?
Well, one thing to remember is that the friction, I would say that there hasn't been, because you can look over the course of the last 10 years, and you cited some numbers at the beginning, that consumers are already making this transition. And it's interesting to point out that a couple of the seniors who I know that the AARP has been working with, some of the newspapers in talking and profiling their stories, all three of the seniors who were interviewed for stories that have been published across the state of Michigan have already transitioned to a VoIP product.
If I may make a comment, I apologize. I'm glad that you brought that up, and I wanted to make a comment about that as well, that we find that alarming that people are being switched over to a voice over internet protocol by their cable companies or other providers, and they're not being educated on the time of that switch. A lot of individuals, especially from AARP standpoint, rely on medical devices and medical alerts and alarm systems. And are they asking those questions at the time of that switch? And if people are automatically switching over to these products and they have this choice is the key point here, why do we need legislation then that's going to do away with landlines with 90 days notice to consumers?
Well, I think to that point, it's a good one, is the exact reason why technicians who work for AT&T, when they go to a consumer's house and they make this installation of the product, they're instructed as part of their protocols to say, are you connected to a life alert service or a medical service or any kind of thing that would, you know, be impacted by this switch? And they're instructed not to leave the premises, not to leave that person's house until they are assured that the systems are working over the new product, and that the consumers know that the services that they had before are going to work with the service that the new product that they have.
Well, that's very comforting to know, but then I would argue, why are the individuals that responded to this study unaware that they are on a voice over internet protocol system? That is what's scary to us and alarming to us, because like I said, a lot of people do rely on these services, and people are now aging in place a lot more and are going to rely on a lot of aging in place services like a medical device or a medical alert system. So are you educating people at that time as well that, you know, if you stay in this system, in this household, some of these devices may not be compatible with our service? Also, I would like to say that even with AT&T's UVerse system, you even having your legal disclosure that 911 may not work like it does with the landline. So there's a lot of concerns with security, with availability, with accessibility, and reliability.
Are there ways to address those concerns within the context of using the voice over internet protocol?
A couple of things. I think, first of all, just to say, you know, 911 is certainly not... That's an incredibly important and reliable service that is a part of the products that we offer our customers. But I would say that the second part of this is that, again, this is why the FCC is taking this into close consideration. The chairman of the Federal Communications Commission, as well as the chairman of AT&T, the CEO of AT&T, have talked about the fact that these questions need to be answered as a part of this transition. But at the same time, the technology that has run our phone system for 100 years is not working anymore, and we need to transition to a system that is a 21st century system as opposed to a 19th century system, and that by doing so the right way, services will become more reliable and, on top of that, better and offer more products and services to businesses and residents across the state.
Well, Matt, I am curious, as Melissa had pointed out, that the current law mm-hmm. permits a provider to discontinue service So it already exists in Section 313 of current law. Why does it need to be changed?
Again, it's really a system of streamlining. There are now two steps in that process. One is currently going before the Michigan Public Service Commission. The second step is then going before the Federal Communications Commission. Because the Federal Communications Commission relies on the MPSC and states to weigh in on this, it's a streamlining of that process to facilitate that and allow it to happen more smoothly.
I
would like to say that the streamlining also means that it takes away from consumer protections. You want somebody from the federal government to come in and analyze specifics about Michigan telecommunications, as opposed to having somebody here who specializes in Michigan and does this work on a daily basis and knows our state frontwards and backwards and is able to understand what a comparable, reliable service is.
Presumably that's exactly why the Michigan Public Service Commission has already become involved in the federal process. They want to make sure that in their role they are looking out for consumers, and why they've taken the time to file twice already with the Federal Communications Commission on this very issue, as the FCC has started this national process.
Is there room for some type of compromise between those who fear these changes, the seniors, for example, that Melissa talks about, and the supporters of Senate Bill 636? Is there a way to find a common ground? I guess I'll start with you on that, Melissa.
Yeah, I will say that we really appreciate all the work that Senator Knopf has given to this legislation. I mean, it was introduced in October, and so we're very happy with the time that he's dedicated. You know, AARP's standpoint is that we're worried about public safety, universal access to all people. You know, even Matt said broadband's only at 98.5%. We can't switch people over to a new system unless everybody is ready for that switch. Competition is a big one. You know, you don't want a monopoly because people will start charging more for their services. And finally, and certainly not last, we're really wanting to ensure that consumer protection component.
Well, I think there is some ground, some area for some common ground, and I think our business is our customers. I mean, without them, we don't have a business, and so as we go forward, this is all about a delivering more and better products to our customers so that they can remain our customers, and so that is certainly our commitment going forward.
We have been talking with Matt Resch, he's the Public Affairs Director for AT&T Michigan, and Melissa Seifert, who's the Associate State Director of the Michigan AARP. I'm sure we will be talking with you both again. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer is Bob Scon. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Emily Fox, Renee Gross, Mercedes Mejia, Katie Suha, Claire Tennisketter, and John K. Wilson. This program's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening. Let's talk tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock.